the oceans from rivers that absorb the pesticides from agriculture and all other pesticide use. Scientists are warning us now that over 90% of coral could be gone forever by 2030. The warning is clear. If we lose the coral, we could quickly see the end of most ocean life and humans could swiftly follow. My name is Rising Moon, and this is a Small World production.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now, the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now, you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song. You've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft. Little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden, Rodale. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song.
Durante and David, together again. I'm David Rothenberg. That was Jimmy Durante. And the program is any Saturday on listener sponsor WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. It's Saturday, August 6th, one of those ominous dates that jumps out at you if you know your world history. It was the day that we dropped a bomb on and obliterated the city of Hiroshima. I remember as a child, I was not formulated, and we were told that we destroyed an entire city of Hiroshima. We were at war with Japan, and that this would end the war. This preteen accepted that bit of information. And then a week later, we dropped another bomb on Nagasaki. And I remember asking if we won the war, or we seemed to have ended the war because we let the Japanese know what we had, why did we have to drop the second bomb? course, in retrospect, I wonder about the first bomb. I wonder if we invited Japan leadership to witness a test. Would it not have been necessary? But it changed. August 6th is a day that changed world history, because we suddenly demonstrated that we had the power to destroy. Ever since, we've been working to display the power to create, to build, to reach out, to touch. So much easier to destroy, isn't it? One bomb. So I don't know, do we observe it? Do we reach out to the survivors of Hiroshima? Are there ceremonies? I suspect that there are in Japan, maybe among some pacifist groups here in the United States and around the world, to remember what we are capable of, which we've already done. And we've had some very dangerous people within reach of the button that could make it happen again. So August 6th is a day that jumps out, certainly for me. What else is in the news? Well, that's not in the news. I'm making news for that for you. Alex Jones, I love this headline in the Daily News today. Speech is free, lies you pay for. Alex Jones hit with $45 million and $45.2 million in punitive damages over Sandy Hook. That's to follow up the $4 million that he was charged with yesterday. And even during the trial, if you had watched any of the news, he was demonizing and sending out lies about the judge in the trial, which was shown to the jury. He is a despicable human being. And there's some of them out there still buying it. Albert Woodfox passed away. It's in the Times today. 75 years old, who spent 42 years in solitary. About 6 years ago, when his book, Solitary, was published, he was a guest on this program. And then when he came to New York, he spent a day with us at the Fortune Society. And he was a man who, because of his politics, he was a panther. The punitive aspects of the Louisiana prison system or the entire criminal justice system was continual punishment for the Panthers that ended up in prison. And I remember saying to him, Albert, you seem, I couldn't see hints of 42 years of solitary confinement. And he said that to me, the scars are well hidden. He spoke at the Fortune Society as well as on BAI, passed away at 75 from COVID, it says. So a man who had a very difficult life, one of the cliches, I hope he's at peace now. No, I don't believe that. I believe he is dead now, but the pain has stopped, hopefully. And I'm glad that he had some years out in the freer world. There's so much to cover. I was so glad the Times had an editorial yesterday reflecting my political thoughts. When I keep getting letters from supporting Democratic Party, and I'm a Democrat, and I hope that they win because I prefer them over the Republicans. But when I started hearing about strategies to support Trump candidates in Republican primaries because they suspected they would be easier to defeat in the election, I said my sentiment is I vote what's best for America. That's not what's best for the Democratic Party. When the Democratic Party is preferable, I vote for them because they are best for America. But I don't want to be told in any primary, and I don't want to be solicited for money from the Democratic Party so that they can aid and abet Trump candidates in the 400 seats that they've been running at all levels around the country. And the Times called it a nadir in political strategy, and I agree with them totally. What else politically? You know, much has been made about Manson and Virginia and the Arizona woman whose name I can never pronounce, Samina, whatever, about trying to get their vote so that they that it, to save the planet. And maybe they maybe we have it now and maybe we can start doing some having some legislation on climate change. And the burden was all put on Manson. And understandably that there was some deep resentment and anger. But do you realize that there are 50 Republicans that are resistant to legislation that which Manson has come on board with, that there should be some questioning to alleged enlightened people in the party, such as Susan Collins and Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski. I don't think we can count on Ron Johnson, Mitch McConnell, Tom Cotton, or Josh Hawley, especially when he's running the other direction. They have to be held accountable, but not. They're not, because on social issues, they sell the fears, and that's what works for them. What else? Oh, I know, politically. Hochul, Governor Hochul has a 10-point lead in New York, according to the polls, if you pay attention to the polls. And people do. I do, to a certain extent. A 10-point lead over a man who's woefully, just so unappealing. Zeldin, Zeiden, Yechich. But the interesting thing is that the polls indicate that she's ahead in New York City, 70-20, 10% undecided. And that around the state, it's pretty close to 50-50, suburbs and upstate. He has a slight lead. In the suburbs, his lead is marginal, not enough difference. That there are enough New Yorkers and enough people in the Empire State that could find him appealing or acceptable as governor. It's not because he's a Republican. It's because he's a terrible Republican. He's been a Trump apologist. His comments on criminal justice are not advanced 19th century. And so the... she has a lead, and in a Democratic state, New York City can pull it through, and let's hope that that's what happens. Am I deliriously joyful about her? No. But as I've said often, I am a social progressive and a political pragmatist. When it comes down to two people, I don't start carrying on unless the two people are so unappealing that a third-party candidate, that a protest vote is legitimate. I don't see it in this case. Let's have some music. In the second hour, our guest will be Jesse Green, theater critic of the New York Times, who has co-authored a book called Shy by Mary Rogers, daughter of Richard Rogers. I waxed eloquently about it last week. I think it's one of the best biographies I've ever read. And one of the, certainly along with William Goldman's The Season, I would rank it as one of the two best theater books I've ever read. And if you've doubted my opinion, tomorrow in the New York Times, of course, the august New York Times, the front cover, well, Jesse, you may never have to review a play again. It is a rave of unprecedented proportions in the Sunday book section. All right, some music. Fats Waller wrote this, and Fats Waller's singing it. And Fats Waller's piano keys are just joyous. Listen to the piano.
Come here, bird. Thank you. I want my mama, but gone is she. A sad, sad sucker am I, yeah. Little birdie on a tree. Mama caught me with a bumblebee on a limb forbidden to me. A sad, sad sucker am I. Yes, I'm a sad, 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 sad sucker. And I like that jive, yeah, man. But I can't have no woman messing around my hive. Little birdie on a tree. Tree mama gave me misery. I'm the kind, pay me no mind. A sad, sad sucker am I. Come on, birdie, tweet with me a while.
The piano keys are the same for everyone. Why is it that when Fats Waller plays, the keys seem to be smiling? There is a joyous sound that emanates from his piano playing, and not only from his impish voice. Boy, I wish I was around when he was playing. He is such a joy to listen to. In the morning when I do my sit-ups and whatever else I do that to get this aged body functioning, I play different people depending on the mood. Hartman, I play Nat Cole, Sinatra, a lot of Pavarotti. But when I play Peggy Lee, when I play Fats Waller, I find myself while I'm lying down, moving the body, sort of dancing in air, because he evokes that kind of feeling. I forgot to tell you that we're listener sponsored. Certainly when all month I'm going to be talking about Mary Rogers, Jesse Green's book, Shy, which you can, I did my review last week and many of you responded. It's going to be available. If you make a $50 gift to WBAI, you can get a copy of this stunning memoir, as it were, if you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. I want to tell you about some of the live theater that we have, though, at this time. At the Joyce Theater, you know I'm in love with everything that comes to the Joyce. For the next Tuesday nights, we have openings, and we have tickets. This Tuesday night, Rennie Harris, the Philadelphia much-heralded hip-hop, came out of the streets, and he started pulling kids out who were outstanding hip hop dancers and choreographing them. And as his company has been, choreographically innovative. And the Rennie Harris Company, I think the first time since COVID, will be coming to the Joyce. We have a couple of pair for Tuesday night, August 9th. You know, the wonderful thing now is when I talk about a dance company, what I do and what you can do, if you have any doubts, you go to Google. And as I did with Rennie Harris, and you take a look, and all you have to do is look at Google, and then you say, oh, that I like. We don't have many for Tuesday, but you can try us. And then the following Tuesday night, we have the Saratoga Ballet, which is much more classical, but brilliantly executed. So for 2 weeks, you can go to the Joyce, $50 to WBAI. You get two tickets. Economically, it's what is known as a gift to us and from us to you. But how wonderful. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. We also have tickets for patients. People are starting to go tonight from WBAI. We have tickets for patients. The second stage is doing it. They have three theaters. This is at their Upper West Side Theater, the McGinn-Cazale Theater. Patients is a play which is a it's the word meditation. It's a play that reflective on Black excellence. It's a group of young Black men and women. And it's described as a coming of age story, one where becoming is equally about questioning as it is about growing. It's as young people, and certainly young people of color, as they coming of age, there are so many questions to ask. And patience, which none of us have seen yet, but I look at the pictures of the five, the two men and three very attractive young actors. It's the kind of, I love that kind of theater about young people being quizzical about where they've been, how have they been shaped, and what is coming, what are the opportunities, what are the possibilities? I don't know what, that's why we go to previews. We decide how good it is. This is Patience, presented by the very excellent, always responsible Second Stage Theater Company. I think we saw it last year. They did Clyde's. Remember, many of you went to see that. So when do we have tickets for patients? Next Saturday matinee and Saturday night. The Sunday matinee tickets are already gone Sunday night. So next Saturday at 2 and 8, $50 for a pair of tickets to see patients. All you have to do is email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. This week, the stories about Roe versus Wade can certainly continue in the news. I listened to a discussion yesterday, and it was, or I don't remember what day, maybe it was Thursday. No, it was Friday. And it was on The View. And the women there tend to be progressive and liberal. Joy Behar, Whoopi wasn't there that day. Is her last name Hoskins? Is reportedly, you know, she says, I'm Catholic and I'm not in favor of abortion for me, but she said she's learned from the other women that it's not her to make that decision about other women and how they deal with the body. A rather responsible and enlightened position, and people can change and they grow. And their guest yesterday was Elizabeth Hasselbeck, who used to be the token conservative on The View. Not token. She was, and she's bright and she's attractive. Her husband's a pro football player. And she gave the predictable argument against abortion and choice, and describing the fetus with a love that if it's only shown for children that are in foundling homes, it would be wonderful. And I, as I listened to her, I said, well, that's her opinion. She's entitled to it. I disagree with her. And then she said something that got me to the core. After she gave her long speech against a woman's right to choose, she said, and I wrote the words down, she said, those are not my words. Those are God's words. Now, there's an argument that you have difficulty disputing. What she has done, and is that symbolic? Is that representative of a conservative or ultra-conservative approach these days? That you justify your political position by citing God's words? Why can't I say, I spoke to God the other day. He didn't say that. He said something else. How can they present that as an argument? Those are not my words. Those are God's words. Where? When? It's frightening. And I am frightened if that kind of thinking, if religion is being used to determine and justify Neanderthal political and social behavior. There you go. More hopeful on that subject is that yesterday there was released voter support, a breakdown of the 50 states and how they would, as a result of Kansas going 58%, almost 60%, revealing a pro-choice sentiment. Kansas in the middle of the country, as conservative as it can possibly be. And there it was. And when you look at this, there are very few states that don't have at least 50% of the people in support of a woman's right to choose. Out west, Wyoming and Utah, Utah 49%, Wyoming 48%, pretty close. So how would people turn out if there were a referendum? And then the big bulk of the negatives were Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. And the states with the lowest percentage are Mississippi and Alabama, not surprising, 44%. But around the country, in Maine, 75% of the people would vote in the polls supportive of a woman's right. Vermont, 86%. Good old Vermont. New York, what is New York's? I can't see it. 70%. I mean, 70% of the people have polled in this state would support a woman's right to choose. And it's Texas, 52%. Arizona, 62%. So there's some hope there. And that if there's enough referendums, and there's a story in the papers this morning that Republicans might be pulling back on referendums, or at least taking a strong position, because it might hurt them politically. Mitch McConnell would do somersaults to become majority leader in the Senate again, and he might have some thoughts about pulling back on this issue if it hurts them politically, because it's cynical of me to say this, but I don't think some of those political strategists and the big money people really care that much about Roe versus Wade. That's a way of mobilizing their, quote, base so that they keeps us not dealing with the economic issues that they're concerned with, such as regulations. That's the biggie. All right, enough of that. Some music. Well, this next song, you know I love Broadway shows, and I found a Broadway musical called Two's Company. Years ago, I worked with a wonderful producer named Mike Ellis, and he had over his desk a sign that said, at tonight's performance, Miss Davis's role, usually played by Miss Betty Davis, will be played by. Of course, I had a different experience with Betty Davis when I worked with her in Night of the Iguana when I was the 83rd assistant press person. She didn't miss performances, and she was an old pro. But when her career was, when Hollywood was turning its back to her, she came to Broadway and did ill-advised and did a musical. Vernon Duke wrote the music. Ogden Nash wrote the lyrics. They surrounded her with talent all over the place. But when you hear her opening number, this is not, I'm not playing that so that you can appreciate musical excellence, but rather Broadway musical theater curiosity. Here's Betty Davis in the chorus with Turn Me Loose on Broadway.
Mr. Conductor, if you please. Don't want to cruise the Riviera. Don't want a diamond mine. Want to smell grease paint in dressing rooms where a coveted Oscar is Hammerstein. Just turn me loose on Broadway under a neon moon. Give me some jokes and a corny routine. Give me a popular tune to warble. Give me four boys to dance with, hoofers who twist and twirl. Just turn me loose on old Broadway as a musical comedy girl. Thank you.
2.
A 3.
A 4.
It's tricky.
Vodo.
Dino.
Boop boop.
Adu.
Hey!
Ha!
Boop boop.
Adu.
Vodo.
Dino.
Hey!
Give me 4 boys to dance with, hoofers who twist and twirl. Just turn me loose on old Broadway as a musical comedy. No melodramedy, musical comedy, girl!
What do you think Margot Channing would have thought of that performance? Oy. I can't help but laughing. Betty, somebody should have told you. Eddie Gibbs came to the Fortune Society on Thursday. He is the first formerly incarcerated person ever elected to the New York State Assembly, or in fact to any state legislature anywhere in the country. He's been a guest on this program, and it is historic. As I've often said, he started a new trend. Hundreds and hundreds of people elected to office ended up in prison. Eddie got it out of the way before. He became an active person in his community, and he became the community board leader. And he started, as he told the men and women at the Fortune Society, what an inspiring talk it was. And it's on YouTube, and I'm going to tell you how to get it. He told them that he wanted to do something. He wanted to give back because he felt he had, as a kid in trouble and acting out as a 16 and 15 year old, that he was bad for the community. And he volunteered at a church nearby. And he said he wasn't a member of the church, but he saw the minister sweeping outside, and he began sweeping. And I told him afterwards that the great civil rights attorney, Flo Kennedy, often said, you have problems with things, you don't like the way things are being run, grab a broom. And that's exactly what he did, as he led himself to on the first step towards a role in the United States Assembly. And he's starting his own club, a Democratic club called the Second Chance Club. It'll be open for people in all 5 boroughs who have had contact with the criminal justice system, which will create a constituency that elected officials did not know, have not known that they have people in their congressional or state or assembly or council district who have had, who are affected by all the barriers and the restrictions for people who have come out of prison, and the gross inhumanity that's inflicted on people who are inside. If you go to on YouTube, if you go to Fortune Society and go to the Eddie Gibbs profile, I think you'll find it if you know how to work that whole kind of thing. I don't. Somebody sent me the link after I had seen Eddie Assemblyman Gibbs speak. I should stop. I should give him the proper respect. Assemblyman Eddie Gibbs. Nice man. Besides all that, I love the way he spoke because he related to the people, and it was almost folksy. It was not a calculated folksiness. That's who he is. He's a guy that he's from the streets, and he got it all together, and he's now assumed a responsible role of leadership. We have tickets for, believe it or not, it's called The Physics Show. It was done 5 years ago. Eric Krebs is bringing it back. And I said I'd never go to see a show called The Physics Show because I was terrible at things like that in school. In college, I had to take a physics course to graduate. I got a C. I memorized things. I didn't understand it. And Eric said, come see it. It was so entertaining. And I said, now this is how physics should be taught in schools. A man named David Maiolo, M-A-I-U-L-L-O. What he does is he's taken physical experiments and they're presented. He's presented them in classrooms across the country, and he has segments on motion, momentum, vacuum, friction, energy, density, fluid motion. It ain't Hamilton, kids, but it's a very different kind of experience. It's a learning experience. I was fascinated by it, ashamed at my resistance to physics, but a little bit angry at the educational curriculum that made it so alien to me. When I saw this man who, and he pulls people up from the audience, you know, I crouched so far in my seat, I didn't want to be called up for any of this. But it's a shame that education can't be so as joyful or as exciting as he made it. You know, last week we had Janice Weinman, the wonderful woman from Education Through Music. Here's another example of it. The physics show is Eric's bringing it back to his theater at 555 West 42nd Street, and previews start next weekend. And we have tickets for, they do a Saturday show at 11 a.m. Bring for the kids. You can listen to me on the radio till 10 o'clock and then rush off to see the physics show, or at 3 o'clock next Saturday at 11 or 3 and next Sunday at 3. Then the whole following week. It's $40 for two tickets to see the physics show. And I think you would find it a different kind of experience. And it's, if you have any youngins in your family that are resistant as I was, or even better yet, take those who are enthralled by science and the challenges of it. The physics show is an interesting idea. And it, and the fact that it was, he's been touring, you know, at conventions and conferences and whatnot. It's important for kids to be able to see something like this. And it was a learning experience for me, as well as joyous. All right. We do something called out on a, by the way, if you want to see the physics show, you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give you a phone number and I'll call you back. It's $40 for a pair of tickets next Saturday at 11 or 3 or next Sunday at 3. All of you people fetching for matinees, there you are. Out on a Limb, an essay I do each week. And I'm about to do it now. I'm David Rothenberg on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. It's no mystery that our world, our lives, have shifted dramatically. The pandemic isolated most of us to varying degrees for a couple of years, and the adjustments and the reentry for us have been strained. People have moved, stores have closed, shaking hands and hugging have been reduced. Fearful of contact. Certainly for young people, 2 years out of school, away from programs, clubs, and all sorts of socialization, that's a large chunk of time for somebody who's 10 or 12 or 14 years old. Teachers have been reporting that more than a few students are undisciplined, walking in and out of classrooms at will, as they did at home while being educated on Zoom. This is national. More perilous is what's happening on the streets and the towns across our country, particularly with young men who pre-pandemic were described or labeled as youths at risk. Those who have had contact with the criminal justice system. For 2 years, these young men had virtually no feedback, many without family or survival resources or health care or safe living conditions. Programs that provide counseling and emotional support operated virtually, which is a weak substitute for the overwhelming needs of thousands of young men. Our streets and our subways are filled with lost souls, a post-pandemic reality, and most are homeless, a danger only to themselves for the most part. Their retreat into alcohol and drugs is part of the pattern. Many in that population have been stabilized by prescription drugs to ease their anxiety, making them less aggressive in social interaction. I have a few thoughts based on my many years working with formerly incarcerated men and women and the aforementioned youths at risk. This is not a deep study or academically inspired investigation, but anecdotal observations that should inspire studies to determine cause and effect, a step in solving problems, reducing street and domestic violence. First, you have to establish trust before you can ask the probing questions. And then there's much to learn. One is that many acting out are off their prescribed meds. They're not taking them. And while the meds tend to keep them calm, not dangerous, it often causes laziness, some aches and pains, altering their moods. But the one aspect of meds rarely discussed is that it intrudes or limits sexual performance and prowess. I've talked with enough men, not that I've reached any conclusions, but certainly that there must be some deep digging why people at risk won't take their meds, and to determine if there are options does the medication not compromise their sexual performance. It remains an undiscussed topic in society. There's an abundance of titillating sexual references in our world, but not about individual choices. It's a topic filled with embarrassment and shame, often shielded by machismo boastings. My question, my challenge, what are the effects of meds on sexuality and its connection with violent or enraged behavior? I'm asking questions. There's something else, a condition which preceded the pandemic, but adds to the problem. Prisons traditionally use drugs to maintain calm, to control obstreperous men and women in their custody. Understandably, they want peace inside their gulags. And for years, Thorazine made zombies of men who were defined by the numbers on their shirts, not by their names. The prisons are packed with young men at the peak of their energy, and they are confined, restricted, which is in prison, that the confinement, the restrictions, is a formula for trouble, which there is. And some young men have said about Rikers Island, the fights relieve the boredom. Incredible to hear. Drugs has been the answer, but prisons have never assumed any responsibility to the communities that will be receiving their wards when the gates are opened. Many men and women who relied on prison prescription drugs are released, often with no medical plan, no continuity. Many struggle in their transition, ineligible for continuity, and they respond accordingly. I don't know how much that is part of today's concern about people with serious mental and emotional issues moving about our cities and towns without guidance, actually without recognition until violence occurs. It's difficult enough for returning citizens to adjust from prison. Reentry is serious business. Add drugs to the quotient, and well, the results could be ominous. I hear the quick fix political solutions. I hear media members pontificating. We need some serious probing about men off their meds and subsequent acts event of random violence. Is anyone listening? I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb. Here's Al Martino.
Ever close to my heart, so darling, say that you care. Take this heart I give gladly. Sure you know I need your love so badly.
Number one on the hit parade for weeks, Al Martino, Hear My Heart. I don't think he ever had another hit. Last week, I talked about this station, how unique, and that with the result of with the introduction of this strange machine called the computer, my hearing from people in unlikely places wondering, why are they listening on a Saturday morning to WBAI from Uganda, from London, from Nigeria, from Staten Island, and from the Philippines. And I, when I said that, then I, shortly after the program, thanks for the Philippine mention. You're correct. This is from Makati, the Philippines. Thanks for the Philippine mention. You're correct. The radio stations and the rest of the media here are either state-sponsored, religious, or have banal pop music with obnoxious commercials. I do have choices on the internet, but BAI and parenthesis GBO for jazz still leagues above all the other U.S. stations for news, commentary, and new music. From the Philippines, he's listening, and we're talking to him. I find it extraordinary as one who started with Marconi on radio, as you may recall. I saw a movie yesterday. There are three movies out about the rescue of the Thailand boys who were caught in a cave. A big review yesterday in the Times about Ron Howard's picture on Amazon. I went to Cinema Village to see a picture called Cave Rescue. Same theme. It is so harrowing. And the filmmaker, it's a recreation. Obviously, it's not filming of what actually happened. But you are there in the caves with the boys, with the rescue teams. Tom Waller made this movie. At points, I had to look away. I knew that I remember the story and that the boys were rescued, but I couldn't. It's a thriller of monumental proportions. The wonderful thing that comes out of it is world people responding from around the world. SEAL, not Hello SEAL, but U.S. Naval SEAL people coming from Hawaii, a trained diver from Ireland, some people who had some sort of tubes that I didn't understand from China, all coming in and working together to get these boys out. And then, of course, at the end of the movie, they show you the news clip, the real boys – being celebrated walking down the hall in the hospitals where they were. I was emotionally drained when I saw it. If that's your kind of thing, it's at the Cinema Village on 12th Street. I wasn't bored. It's very exciting. There was nobody else in the theater either but me, which is a nice way to watch a movie. Ethel Waters will now sing to you. We're getting ready to hear to have our guest Jesse Green, but let's hear from Ethel, and then we'll play something by Carol Burnett. Ethel.
We're talking of gals they knew. Women are all the same, said Joe. One dizzy bird said, pal, ain't you heard the story of true blue loo? Listen and get an earful, bow. Say, she was a dame in love with a guy. She stuck to him, but didn't know why. Everyone blamed her, still they all named her True Blue Lou. He gave her nothing, she gave him all. But when he had his back to the wall, who fought to save him, smiled and forgave him, True Blue Lou. He got a break and went away to get a new start. But poor kid, she never got a break except the one way down in her heart. Maybe somewhere in heaven above, there's a reward for that kind of love. Angels won't blame her, they too will name her. But gosh, that poor kid, she never got a break except the one way down in her heart. But maybe somewhere in heaven above, there's a reward for that kind of love. Angels won't blame her, they too will name her True Blue.
As Richard Writing and Leo Robbins wrote that song, as you know, I majored in name dropping. And so I'll let you know that the first theater office, press office I worked in back in the 50s, they were representing a show called Ethel Waters Off Broadway at the 41st Street Theater. And I went to see her. And of course, she was wonderful. And there was no one coming to see her. And I had sort of known who Ethel Waters was because after Member of the Wedding. But then I started reading about her and what a great star she was. And by the time she was doing this one-person show, what do people who sing and dance do? That's what they have. That's how they make their living. And it was kind of sad because here was this woman who was the toast of the town at one point. And she was good. She still could deliver a song, but there it was, Ethel Waters. I'll do a book review, then we'll a theater review. It's virtually impossible not to be caught up in the emotional maelstrom of the stage adaptation by Matthew Spangler of Khalil Hassani's novel, The Kite Runner. Now comfortably situated at the Helen Hayes Theater in a production adroitly staged by Giles Kraft, The Kite Runner, a best-selling book, an acclaimed film, has successfully achieved that rare triple threat, vivid in all mediums. Amir, played by Amir Arisa, now living in San Francisco, tells the story of his Afghanistan childhood. He, the son of one of Kabul's most successful businessmen, Amir's childhood is centered in this play on his friendship with Hassan, the son of his father's devoted servant. The Kite Runner spans decades and familiarizes the audiences with Mideast political upheavals, immigration machinations, and social class distinctions. But at its core, the story's great strength is the emotional pull between Amir and his needy, devoted friend, Hassan, who he has disappointed, who he has betrayed. Amir Arison is formidable as the storyteller, but it is the Broadway debut of a young man named Eric Sarakian that pulls at the heartstrings. As Hassan, he is Amir's partner in the symbolic kite-flying contest and remains loyal through travesty and the betrayal. The young actor's performance is stunning. Make no mistake, The Kite Runner envelops the audience. At the performance I attended, when the play concluded, there was this long silence, followed by thunderous applause. We were in this world that they brought us in, and it took that long pause to realize we were back at the Helen Hayes Theater. Now that's theatrical magic. The Kite Runner at the Helen Hayes Theater. Carol Burnett made her debut in a musical called Once Upon a Mattress, the music written by Richard Rodgers' daughter, Mary Rodgers. This is the song that made a star, or made everybody sit up and take notice of Carol Burnett, and realize that Mary Rodgers had more than being Richard Rodgers' daughter to add to her resume. We will be talking with Jesse Green, who co-authored Shy with Mary Rodgers, but first we're going to hear the song that brought Mary Rodgers to our attention. Carol Burnett, Shy.
Well, who's the lucky man? Hey, Nani, Nani, is it you?
Hey, Nani, 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 no.
Hey, Nani, Nani, is it you?
Hey, Nani, 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 no.
Hey, Nani, Nani, is it you? Are you, are you, are you, are?
Nani, noni, nini, nani, noni, nani.
No, no, no. Someone's being bashful. That's no way to be. Not with me. Can't you see that I am just as embarrassed as you? And I can understand your point of view. I've always been shy. It's wrong to be meek as I am. My chances may pass me by. I pretend to be strong, but as weak as I am, all I can do is try. God knows I try, though I'm frightened and shy. And despite the impression I give, I confess that I'm living a lie, because I'm actually terribly timid. Suddenly confronted with romance, and she's likely to fall on her face when she's finally face to face with a pair of pants. Quite often the lady's not as hard to please as she seems. Quite often she'll settle for something less than the man of her dreams. fishing for a mate. I'm gonna look in every brook. But how much longer must I wait with bated breath and hook?
Jesse Green, good morning.
Good morning, David.
Isn't it wonderful to have Carol Burnett sing the title of your book?
I didn't.
John Grisham never had that.
And she could still do it today, I'm sure.
I'm sure. I had a million questions I was going to start off asking you this morning, and then I picked up my advanced section of tomorrow's New York Times, which I'm sure you have seen, and every author should have this kind of a kickoff, the big front page picture of Mary and Richard Rogers. But before I ask a question, if I may, I'm going to read a sentence from Daniel Okrent's review, the first paragraph. He writes,
oh,
I'm a sucker. Pardon me?
Please read it. It's fabulous.
Now you know what a good review is, can do to somebody. I'm also a sucker for books about Broadway, books as different from one another as Morse Hart's Act One, William Goldman's The Season, and Jack Rattel's The Secret Life of the American Musical. But I've never read one more entertaining and more revealing than Mary Rogers Shy. Her voice careens between intimate, sardonic, confessional, and comic. The book is pure pleasures, except when it's jaw-dropping shocking. Wow.
Well, you know, David, that's because that's who she was. Those adjectives are absolutely descriptive of Mary and of the reason I wanted to do the book, because the experience I had sitting with her, in her living room or chatting at a cocktail party or wherever I met her before I knew her well, was exactly that experience. And I thought everybody should have it too.
Well, she passed away 8 years ago, so it's taken that much time to get it all together. I want to say this as when I reviewed it, I had said on paper, Mary Rogers' rapier wit and ferocity is almost intimidating. So in awe by her jibes and observations, I then Googled her. And then I took in a couple of the television interviews and I discovered that the candor and the wit was offered by this charming, self-confident woman. And that which seemed so intimidating in print was so inviting in the flesh.
Well, that's right. That's right. She was, I can understand how people reading a transcript might feel, oh, my gosh, you know, who is this opinionated lady who takes no prisoners? But in fact, if you spend time with her, she was incredibly warm and funny and self-deprecating also. So I wanted to make sure those qualities came through in the book as well.
And it did, certainly. So you just gave some good adjectives, but just besides the fact that she was Richard Rogers' daughter, and she doesn't, she's not coy about that as many children of famous people are. That was part of her resume.
Yeah.
Who was she?
Well, Mary Rogers was a woman born into a certain kind of showbiz privilege in 1931. Her father was already becoming famous as half of Rogers and Hart and would soon become very famous in that partnership. and then a little bit later with as Rodgers and Hammerstein. But for all of the privilege and the kind of cultural hotbed of that upbringing, she was also stifled by it because her father wasn't just some composer. He was, as many people feel, the great American melodist. She and a very cold fish and depressive and an alcoholic and a womanizer. And her mother was had her own tray of difficult adjectives to go with her. So it was a tough family to grow up in for both reasons. And then, too, you know, although she didn't make too much of it, when we talked, it gradually came out. To be a woman in a man's field during those years, was as she emerged as a composer herself, was not the easiest thing that there was. There had virtually been no women composers on Broadway, one or two perhaps, a few songs here and there, but she was the, you know, basically the first. And also to be a Jewish woman in the upper echelons of wealth in New York, where, for instance, Jewish girls could not have debuts. They were not allowed to be debutantes. So there were all these things also working against her finding her way, while at the same time creating in her a great ambition to do well and to lift up other artists as well. And in the end, that was her main wish in life, was to support other artists, which she wound up doing as the chairman of the board of Juilliard for many years.
And there's an astounding part that I would have never predicted. I did know that she was the mother of Adam Gattell, the composer, but that she had six children and loved being pregnant. That's a side, it's almost incongruous with somebody who's career-driven like that. What are her children's response? I'm sure they've all read the book and you've talked with them. How does the legacy envelop them?
Well, it's fascinating, the story of her children. Five of them survived into adulthood. They're all amazing people of great talent and extremely different. So their responses have been very different. I think in general, they are glad to have their mother's story being told and to have another generation of people, you know, hearing who she is and hearing it, you know, largely in her own voice. But at the same time, if you can imagine someone writing a 440-page book about your mother, it's a very bizarre experience. And Mary was very, very clear that she did not want it to be her children's book. She put a stipulation in our agreement that they could not read the book until it was done. She didn't want they or anyone else to censor what she had decided she wanted to talk about. And since honesty and forthrightness was sort of her brand, she wanted to make sure that got preserved in the way the book finally came out. So I've heard some very happy responses from the kids and some understandable concerns as well.
About their privacy. Well, you know, when I was reading it, I said, this is almost anthropology. She is to Broadway what Margaret Mead is to Samoa. She has, to hear her, as a theater nut, which I am, as you are, to read about somebody hanging out with Larry Hart when she was a kid. I never heard anyone, you know, we've heard the rumors about Larry Hart, but he was somebody who liked him, who was in the house with them. That's...
Well, when she got sick at school and her mother refused to come pick her up, Larry Hart sent his limo to pick her up. You know, these were not... outsized figures to her. They were just, you know, Uncle Larry or you know, all the people.
Well, go into Sondheim, that friendship. How did they meet?
Yes,
and that's extraordinary for theater lovers.
This is one of the big surprises of the book, and one I certainly didn't know about until, I would say, about 8 months into our work together, Mary dropped that bombshell on me. I knew, of course, that they had been friends since teenage years. They met at the home of Aki, as Mary called him.
Yes.
We know him as Oscar Hammerstein II.
Yes, well, I wouldn't call him Aki.
No, well, nor would you call her father Dick.
No.
But anyway, Aki and his wife, who, like her mother, was named Dorothy, had a kind of collection of their own children, but also stray children from other homes, mostly unhappy homes. And at some point when she believes her father was visiting Aki's home in Bucks County, possibly working on Oklahoma, she was along and she met this boy. This boy was one of those strays that the Hammersteins picked up. And his name was Steve Sondheim, and he was she was 13, I think, and he was 14 or something like that.
Why was he a stray?
Well, as you'll read and as you know from reading the book, she wasn't exactly a stray, but she was estranged in a major way from her family. She was not happy in her home.
Asking why Sondheim? But tell us both.
His parents had divorced, and he'd been left with his mother, who, by all accounts, was a nasty piece of work, who was called Foxy. That was her sobriquet, and who famously wrote to him many years later saying that the one regret she had in life was giving birth to him. So I think you get a sense of the kind of environment in which he grew up. And she had a house in Bucks County or something like that. Anyway, he was not far away from where the Hammerstein farm was. So he was introduced to Hammerstein, and Hammerstein took him under his wing and later would become his mentor and taught him everything that he could teach a young boy and a young man later. It was because of Hammerstein that Sondheim agreed to do West Side Story and Gypsy, shows he did not wish to do because he considered himself a composer, not a lyricist. In any case, at age 14, he was, wandering around and met this Mary Rogers character at the house on the farm in Bucks County. And what did they do? Of course, they played a game. The theme of games goes through the book. And they played a game of chess, two games of chess. He wiped her off the map instantaneously, she says. And then he went to the piano and played some Gershwin. And basically, by the end of that day, she was in love with him. At first, a girlhood crush, she was 13. And later it developed into a profound love, admiration, and even a quasi-romantic relationship that resulted at one point, and this was the shock to me that she got,
yes.
They had a kind of trial marriage. They decided they would give it a year where they would live together as man and wife, except it never quite worked, possibly because he was gay, and possibly for many other reasons. And it's a kind of unbearably tense scene where they're trying to pretend to be a couple that way. And it didn't work, and their friendship resumed and remained strong with some explosions here and there until the end of her life. So it is a strong arc in the book, following their closeness over the course of 60 years. And I should say, they wrote together. That some people know the song The Boy from, which was a comedy number from The Mad Show, to which she wrote the music and he wrote the lyrics. But for about 10 years, they were working together fairly frequently, trying to break into the market with all kinds of songs, some of which are quite delightful and some of which are clearly youthful work. And it was in that kind of crucible of working together that their relationship really got solidified.
One of the other things that I learned from the book, Jesse Green, co-author with Mary Rogers on her memoir, Shy. I knew about Once Upon a Mattress. As a matter of fact, Jesse, my first work in the theater was at a press office handling Once Upon a Mattress when it moved to the Alvin. So I knew Mary Rogers not as Richard Rogers' daughter, but as the composer of a show I was working on and as the 18th assistant press person. But I didn't know, is it Freaky Friday? And she was a best-selling author and all these books. And tell us about that.
Well, after Once Upon a Mattress, she didn't have as much luck with the musical theater. She had an off-Broadway hit called The Mad Show, based on Mad Magazine. And then things just kept going wrong, typically legally wrong. There would be rights problems or somebody went crazy. I mean, you can read all about it in the book. Some of them are kind of typical stories intensified of Broadway naughtiness, but she wrote a show called Hotspot for Judy Holliday that wound up being a disaster. She wrote quite a beautiful show called based on The Member of the Wedding by Carson McCullers, which unfortunately it wound up having the rights taken away, and none of that gorgeous music can ever be performed as part of the show. So there was a lot of disappointment, and at some point she said she just didn't feel like she was getting any further in that direction, and she had other arrows in her quiver. She felt that one of the advantages of being a woman of that period, an overlooked advantage, was that unlike men of that period, who, the ones she knew, felt they had to succeed at the top level at all costs or their whole lives were failures, she felt, well, that didn't work, or that worked as much as it did, and now I have other things I can do. So she was approached about writing a children's book, and she did, and then she wrote another one that became one of the most successful children's books of the era, called Freaky Friday, made over as movies and musicals, and there's a whole series of books that she wrote along with it that were extremely successful and brought her to a whole new audience. And then
and filmed three times. Who would know? Isn't it interesting? We live in cubicles, and I didn't know about all of that.
I knew about that because of my own kids, but and the books are still widely read. As Once Upon a Mattress is still extremely frequently performed. It was very cleverly constructed, not for this reason, but as a result of the fact that it has so many principal roles, schools love to do it because they can get a lot of kids on stage.
I want to go into the Once Upon a Mattress. Let me do a BAI commercial. We're listener sponsored, and as you listeners know, I get theater tickets for people, and you support us. We also got a whole bunch of copies of Shy. And if you make a gift of $50 to listener sponsor WBAI, you will get a copy of Mary Rogers, Jesse Green's book, Shy. All you have to do is email me today at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give your phone number and you'll hear from us, and we'll get you the book. Now, that's the commercial. Jesse Green, she did Once Upon a Mattress, and the history of it is fascinating because it started in the Catskills, and they needed a play to fill. They had nine people under contract, so they needed a musical to give everybody a part. I've never heard of anything like that.
Well, Tamament, which is the name of the place in the Catskills that you're referring to, and was a kind of a training camp and hotbed for young musical theater talent and comic talent, was run by this guy named Mo Hack, if you can believe it. That was really his name. And, he was apparently a sweetheart, but a very practical guy. He had every Sunday a new group of, young singles coming to the place, staying for 6 days, and they got a show on Sunday, and they got another show on Saturday, and he had to keep feeding that machine. So, and he had on staff a bunch of paid players who he had to keep employed and make it worth the amount he was paying them, which frankly probably wasn't very much. So when Mary and her collaborator, Marshall Bearer, a brilliant and crazy
lyricist,
came to him and said, well, we're thinking about this idea for a musical based on the fairy tale, The Princess and the Pea. He said, okay, great, but you have to use all nine of my featured players and you have 3 weeks. So thus began a very intense period creating what was a rather different version of the show we know now, but the template for it certainly. And they created the part of the mute king because the guy they had to use as the king couldn't sing. So they said, okay, well, we won't have him talk. We won't have to worry about that. And the one who could barely move, they put her in a cage and lowered it from the ceiling. So she, so they wouldn't have to worry about
that. Jesse, I love the part that the king couldn't sing, because then we were blessed with Jack Guilford when it moved to the Phoenix. Isn't it funny how history works?
When they brought it to New York, first off Broadway, as you say, at the Phoenix, and George Abbott came on. Of course, the entire cast was changed, and he and his casting director, who was in fact his daughter, and that's a whole other story, which Mary tells, you know, did an amazing job of finding brilliant interpreters, including the great Carol Burnett for the lead. But there is a kind of shocking story I'd like to highlight just briefly here, which is when they were casting for the role of the icy queen, who is against the marriage of the Hoyden princess to her delicate son. And they brought in to audition the wonderful Jane White. And she auditioned, and Abbott immediately said, and Jane White was black. And Abbott said, no black queens. And he wasn't having it. He claimed it wasn't racist, but just that it was a medieval kingdom, and how could they have a black queen? Not really having the imagination to say, well, it's all fiction. Well, who cares what race the person is? So, and this is a terrible moment, but they very much, Mary and Marshall very much wanted her to be in the show, and she very much wanted to be in it. And they asked her if she would consider going to this famous makeup artist they knew and coming back to audition with her skin lightened, basically in whiteface. And she said, you know, that's very hard for me. You know who my father is, right? Well, her father was the longtime head of the NAACP.
So, Walter White, right.
Walter White. So what happens, you can read in the book. But these are the kinds of stories that the book has a lot of laugh-out-loud comic stories, but there's a fair amount of really sad and pertinent social drama going on in them as well. And the story of Jane White is certainly one of them.
And you mentioned George Abbott. I made a list of people, and everybody in, that's ever worked in the theater in the second half of the century's name appears. I mean, you mentioned people that have touched my life that I haven't heard. One I call Temple, Texas, Louis Dalmeida, Roger Englander. I was thrilled to read about people who I knew long, long ago. But then the luminaries. And the interesting thing is they weren't luminaries to her. They were the people at the house. You tell the George Abbott story and the Stephen Sondheim story, but Lenny was Leonard Bernstein.
Well, we forgot to mention that she worked from the very beginning on the Young People's Concerts with Bernstein.
With Lenny.
Was, yes, with Lenny, right. Well, nobody was called by the name that they were actually given.
Well, she refers to Arthur Lawrence as Awful Arthur all the time. It's
Well,
I mean, we've heard stories about Awful Arthur and Jerry Robbins, but she doesn't pull any punches. She lets you know what she thought of them.
Yeah, well, the story of Arthur Lawrence is a really interesting one, you know, but basically, and this is one of the things I loved about Mary and that I hope I preserved in the book. She came to understand, she was Arthur's friend for a long time, even as other people were, you know, dropping him every year, somebody else would say, I can't deal with that horrible man anymore. But she didn't for the longest time. And she came to understand that she had stood by and watched him behave this way and was complicit in his bad behavior out of fear that she would be the next victim. And so she blamed herself for having stuck with him for so long. Eventually, she dropped him too, as did Sondheim famously. And, you know, I don't know who he was left with, if anyone, at the end.
Tom, his friend.
Well,
Tom.
And then Tom died. But, that's not a happy part of the story. But, of course, as Mary
it reveals her candor. And the other part of it, here she was a woman at the forefront of many things, and she was very aware of her role as a woman, but kept insisting, didn't see herself as a feminist, and yet was at the forefront of everything in her field for women. Had she come to terms with the contradiction in that?
Yes, she... looking back on it, understood that she just didn't know enough about feminism. She recognized that she had been living it without really knowing that's what it was and without talking about it in those terms. As she got older, she certainly did, and she participated in a lot of the work of feminism in the last 30 years of her life. So it was certainly something she believed in, but she was very wrapped up in creating her own world, which meant her writing, her desperate need to be married, you know, which was her own psychological thing, and her wanting to have children.
Tell us, well, she had two marriages, but the second one, with all this mishigash going on, her second marriage was 50 years, 52 years or more?
Something like that. They were married in, I think, 61, and Hank died in, I forget the math, but yes, a very long and quite successful marriage. As I say, that marriage, she had three children from her first marriage, three great kids in a pretty unhappy marriage. That another shock, something I didn't know, and something I think perhaps her kids didn't know either. There was violence in that marriage. And in the end, that was the reason that she finally split from him. And in the second marriage, she had three more children, one of whom died. And that's a terrible story in the book. But there, you know, she loved having kids. She was perhaps not the most attentive mother in the world because she was also running around doing all this other stuff. But they, nevertheless, those kids are all quite successful. And it was such an important part of her life, along with everything else, that I think she didn't recognize that what she was doing was, in fact, feminism. It was, making your own life without reference to what other people, especially men, told you your life should be. Men were telling her her whole life. She couldn't write. That it was long suspected and gossiped about. People thought her father wrote her music for her because they couldn't believe a woman could write that music. She was hit on by all sorts of people. Julie Stein, who would, call for meetings with her on the pretense of discussing a project, and then out came the grabby hands. You know, she really went through the ringer with all that sort of stuff, but with, in the end, a tremendous amount of good humor.
But besides being candid about daddy, I mean, Richard Rogers' daddy,
yes,
she also brings up something. It's a book for you to think about, Jesse, and that is the number of men who were married and who were gay, and it wasn't marriages of convenience. It's what you did for, I don't know what the reasons are, Lenny Bernstein, yeah, and Felicia Montalegre and Richard Halliday and Mary Martin. She makes no apologies or hides any of this, but that there was a series of, in the theater, maybe elsewhere, yeah, in society, gay men marrying because could they not have careers without having a marriage? So much is about the womanizing of the men in the theater. This was another aspect that she unfolds.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing that could bear, as you say, its own book. But, at one point her father was trying to warn her off of, I think she was in between her marriages. She had a lot of affairs. She was trying to figure out who she was and what she wanted. And one of them was with her collaborator, the crazy and brilliant Marshall Bearer, who was totally gay. And, it's almost bizarre now that, to think of that. And yet when her father, for the first time ever, possibly, interfered with her in a direct way in her personal choices like that, and said, you cannot do that. Those marriages never work. And she thought about it, and she said, actually, they do work.
They do work. They did. And I don't know how, but they did. Although I didn't realize that Lenny left Felicia. Well, I did sort of know that, but...
Yes, near the end of her life, he finally did leave her, but I don't actually.
But they adored each other. Well, that's a whole other book.
They did, and they had three great children too.
Yeah, yes, wonderful kids. But I bring that up only because she hits on so many things. Before we lose you, it's those kind of questions about how do you write the book that it's almost imperative that I ask. But you really answer it in the final chapter. I kept thinking, how did they get together? And then you tell the story. But maybe you can share with us. Did you know her before you were writing the New York piece on her son, Adam? And who was he?
I was assigned to write a piece about Adam Gettle, one of her five children. For the New York Times Magazine, actually, when he was writing a show called The Light in the Piazza. He is also an extremely fine composer. I think one of the great composers of his generation.
And Floyd Collins is coming back and should be seen. Yes, it's a wonderful musical.
Absolutely. And he has more in the pipeline if they would ever get out of the pipeline. But anyway, so I was writing about him. And for that article, I decided, well, I've heard about this Mary Rodgers Gettle for years. And her husband, Hank, let me see if I can meet them. Maybe they'll talk to me. Little did I know that when I was invited to their apartment, not only would they talk to me, they wouldn't stop talking to me. I mean, really, things that almost anyone else would keep quiet about, in order that they should not go into a profile of their son. They just like let it rip. And I had to kind of act as the censor. I mean, some of it I felt just wasn't really appropriate, but I loved it, and they were just everything I kind of dreamed, you know, I would find it. I should mention that I was, you know, when I was a teenager, I was in Once Upon a Mattress in two different productions, one at camp and one at school. So,
what did you play?
Well, in my high school production, I was Prince Dauntless, and at
Joe
camp,
Bova.
I was one of the courtiers named Sir Studley. Amusingly enough. Anyway, so I met them, and they loved the piece that resulted. I don't think Adam loved it so much, but no one ever does like the piece about themselves. And over the years, we would see each other at this or that, at encores, and then we became friends. And around that time, Mary was asked to write her memoirs, and everybody thought she should, except Stephen Sondheim, who told me when I mentioned that I was working with her on the memoirs, he said, why? What's so interesting about Mary? Anyway, and she tried to write it, but she was not happy with what she was doing. She didn't like writing at that point, and she didn't like the result, and she vacated the contract, and then she started it up again, and then she vacated it, and then she came to me and said, could we do this together? It would be so much fun. That's the way I want to do this. And I was like, yes, we can. Let's do that. And we spent the last 3 years of her life meeting twice a week for 4 hours a day and blending into lunch, talking. And I was typing every word she said and many of the words I said, because from the beginning she said she didn't want it to be an autobiography. She didn't want to be and then I wrote. She didn't want it to be self-serving. She didn't want it to be chronological. There were a lot of things she didn't want it to be based on a lot of books she had read that she didn't really care for. And we were constantly discussing how we could use the material, reshape it, rewrite it. And unfortunately, before we got to the writing part, she died. And so I then took quite a long time, because I had another job, writing, taking these hundreds and hundreds of pages of notes and basically treating them as the raw material for the book.
So all that we've covered, one thing I failed to suggest or to mention, it is so funny. There are points that it's been a long time since I read a book, and I had to put it down because I laughed so hard. I was keeping a list because I was taking credit for some of the lines and the descriptions. You know, we do that in the theater. You know, somebody wants a guide, you're funny. And then somebody else said, every line he has is from All About Eve or The Boys in the Band. That's what we do. But the Shy is so filled with original, funny descriptions of people and of situations. It is such a joy to read. Now, we're not going to let you go without the inevitable question that's asked of the New York City Times critic.
Oh, okay.
And that is, and this is a very simple one. A new season is beginning. Do you anticipate particular shows? Are there you can decide what you're going to see and what you're not. Now, do you have preconceived notions of, not about the quality, about whether you're interested in it or not? And I will cite one example. I've been out Willie Loman. I don't think I could see another Willie Loman. And then I saw Wendell Pierce is doing it with an all-black cast, and I said, that I'd like to see. Does that happen to you, or as a critic, do you have to numb yourself from anticipation?
Well, I think anticipation is fine, and I'm very excited to see some things that I have no critical opinion of yet because I haven't seen them, and a few others that are coming from earlier productions where I have seen them and have already liked them. And those I'm allowed to anticipate with excitement because I've already written reviews of them in some other incarnation. So both of those things apply. In this case, with The Death of a Salesman you mentioned, you know, I think he's a marvelous actor, and playing Linda Loman is Sharon D. Clarke, who was the Caroline in Caroline Our Change last year. So though I have not seen this, the production in London where it originated, I think it's fair to say that I'm quite excited about it and excited about the idea of continuing the process. This is one of my things. You know, I don't expect everyone to agree. Continuing the process of rethinking the American canon in light of the actual population of America. I want to see this play performed by black actors. I think that's going to be exciting. A musical that I saw off-Broadway last season that is coming to Broadway and that I loved off-Broadway is called Kimberly Akimbo.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say that.
Based on the what had been a non-musical play by David Lindsay-Abaire, and with a score with lyrics by him and music by Janine Tesori, who wrote Caroline Our Change, and starring the great Victoria Clarke.
She's wonderful in it, but why am I as not enthused as everybody else?
Well, maybe you didn't like it. I mean, this
I did like it, but I did like it, but I was startled to see that it's going to Broadway. There's no chorus line. There's no, I don't know what the commercial.
There's room on Broadway generally each year for one smaller sleeper hit. I mean, we've had a few of them. Fun Home, you know, was the case where everyone said the same thing. Also by Janine Tesori, come to think of it. There isn't a lot of room. There isn't a lot of audience, but there's enough if a show is really excellent to for a show like that to make its way and from there into the culture, which is the real reason a show like that wants to go to Broadway. You really, it's only still, in a, you know, despite Broadway being this kind of tacky land of, you know, candlesticks and cats, it's still the place where if you want to get your story known in the rest of the world, you have to pass through that funnel to get to the regional theaters and to the schools and to the international market. So I welcome at least one show like that getting to Broadway in a year. For the rest, I'm writing my fall preview now, and you can read about it in the New York Times in a couple weeks.
Well, I read it. There's a piece tomorrow by you. I want to ask you this. If they make a movie out of Shy, could be. Who would play Mary? Who could play Mary Rogers?
Well, I've have thought about that, David, and I would appreciate your thoughts as well. But you know,
well, everybody I think of is dead. Everybody. Well,
How about Linda Lavin? How about Christine Baranski? How about
Christine Ebersole?
Christine Ebersole. Christine, you know, the book takes her from a young age to her death, so.
So Lindsay Lohman as a young one, and Linda or Christine as an older actress. All right.
I think it's a fun part that a lot of actresses would probably enjoy doing. Who knows? Maybe Mary.
Is there talk of it? Have you been reached? Has anybody called you yet?
The book isn't even out yet.
That doesn't stop the film industry. They smell things.
Yeah. Well, I haven't heard tell of it yet.
Okay. We're going to go out with a song called Happily Ever After. Then I want to tell everybody how they can get a copy of the book. And I want to thank Jesse Green, drama critic of the New York Times, co-author, is that the fair way, who authored Shy with Mary Rogers about her extraordinary memoir, Shy. Jesse, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, David.
Here's Carol Burnett from Once Upon a Mattress.
And so, young Prince Valdair, after having slain the dragon Fafnir, rescued the princess Grigga, and together they mounted his horse Trigga, and rode off to the castle Wunderbar, where they were married and lived happily ever after. Well, I'm glad. They all lived happily, happily, happily ever after. The couple is happily leaving the chapel eternally tied. As the curtain descends, there is nothing but loving and laughter. When the fairy tale ends, the heroine's always a bride. Ella, the girl of the cinders, did the But she landed a prince who was brawny and blue-eyed and blonde. Still, I honestly doubt that she could ever have done it without that crazy lady with the wand. Cinderella had outside help. I have no one but me. Fairy godmother, 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 where can you be? I haven't got a fairy godmother. I haven't even got a godmother. I have a mother, a plain, ordinary woman. Snow White was so pretty, they tell us, that the queen was insulted and jealous when the mirror declared that Snow White was the fairest of all. She was dumped on the border, but was saved by some men who adored her. Oh, I grant you, they were small, but there were seven of them, practically a regiment. I'm alone in the night, by myself, not a dwarf, not an elf, not a goblin inside. That girl had seven determined little men working day and night just for her. Oh, sure, the queen gave her a poison apple. Even so, she lived happily, happily, happily ever after. A magical kiss counteracted the apple eventually. Though I know I'm not clever, I'll do what they tell me I have to. I want some happily ever after to happen to me. Rapunzel had platinum tresses that were double the length of her dresses. She was kept in a tower for years by a wicked old witch. Till one night in despair, down she scrambled by letting her hair down. That's what I call quite a switch. I wonder. No, that'll never do. I'll be finished before I begin. And besides, I don't want to get out. I want to get in. I want to live happily, happily, happily ever after. I want to walk happily out of the chapel, eternally tied. For I know that I'll never live happily ever after. Till after I'm a bride, then I'll be happily happy.
Carol Burnett from Once Upon a Mattress, music by Mary Rogers. The book, Shy, I'm offering it all month. It's a premium that WBAI is offering. If you buy tomorrow's New York Times, it's the cover book review, a rave by Daniel Laurent. He said what one of, I was going to say that he writes, I'm a sucker for books about the theater, and he mentions the great ones, Morse Hart's Act One, William Goldman's The Season, and Jack Rattel's The Secret Life. But he says, I've never read one more entertaining, more revealing than Mary Rogers' Shy. I was going to say that anybody interested in the American theater, there are two books now that I would suggest you read. And I would thought maybe throw in Morse Hart's Act One, just to understanding the chemistry of it. But William Goldman's The Season became the great screenwriter. And Mary Rogers Shy, and in addition to by telling her life as you follow it, we learn so much about how a play, a show gets on, some of the complications around the personalities that add or intrude to it. It's just wonderful. If you're even thinking of supporting BAI for any shape or form, I can't think of a better premium for you to get than this book that will, it's the book of the summer. I'm sure it'll be on the top of the bestseller list in 2 weeks. There's no reason why it shouldn't be. Anyway, if you're interested, $50 to us, you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Leave your phone number and I'll call you. Okay. That's it. In the world of sports, it was a big story this week. Deshaun Watson, the quarterback for the Cleveland Browns, getting $8 million, facing a six-game suspension because he allegedly had dozens of sexual improprieties, as it said, not necessarily rape, but presumptions, lots of different women, all settled out of court. They didn't go to court. And the NFL has... so far, it's up for appeal, suspended for six games. Not one. I watched the sports programs, ESPN. Not anyone mentioned that Colin Kaepernick hasn't played professional football for 4 years, 5 years, since he kneeled, since Donald Trump accused him of aiding and abetting foreign countries to, betraying our boys overseas and the flag because he kneeled. He kneeled. He kneeled during the national anthem as a quiet, dignified First Amendment statement in protest to young black men being killed by cops. That's all he did. He kneeled. He didn't march. He didn't protest. He didn't do anything that made Donald Trump grab a Bible and hold it upside down in front of a church he never went to. He kneeled. And there's a big discussion about whether six-game suspension for a man accused of 24 sexual attacks. I'm not quite sure, you know, saying all that. I'm not sure if employees should be firing people for what they did. That's up for the courts to determine. It's complicated. My issue was Colin Kaepernick, not Deshaun Watson. Let's hear from Fats Waller. He sings well.
You say you want it? Well, come and get it.
Always walking about some loving, raising cane about turtle doving. Come on now, so there'll be no shoving. Come and get it. You've got two eyes that's so appealing, got two lips that set me reeling, other things that start that feeling. Come and get it. Now if you're gonna love me and be my tutti frutti, don't just turtle dove me. I gotta get myself some booty. Now if you want to get me falling, come on baby, quit that stalling. It's the last time that I'm calling. Come and get it, yeah. Love me. Come on, be my tutti frutti, yes. I don't want that just turtle dove me stuff. I gotta get myself some booty, yeah.
Great Fats Waller. I want to remind you that we have tickets for Patience next week, if you have the patience. Second stage production off Broadway at the McGann-Cazale Theater on 79th and Broadway. A meditation on Black excellence about young people of color, coming of age story where becoming is equally about questioning as it is about growing. Five young African-American, two men, three women, and a new play, which I can only tell you what it's about because the previews are just starting this weekend. We have tickets for next Saturday matinee and Saturday night and next Sunday night. For patients, $50 for a pair of tickets. If you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Tickets for the physics show. This was a prize winner done 5 years ago. Having another production. It's this extraordinary man who makes physics come to life. It may not sound like theater, but it really is. It's kind of joyous. His name is David Maiolo. And he features segments on motion, momentum, vacuum, friction. Great, great for the young people. If you want to take grandchildren or children or yourself to have a fun time, the physics show, $40 for a pair of tickets next Saturday at 11 or 3 or next Sunday at 3. And then, of course, if you want to get a copy of the Jesse Green memoir with Mary, which he co-authored with Mary Rogers Shy, one of the best books about the theater, one of the best memoirs I've ever read. It is so vivid. And from page one, you're just caught up in her life. And you know, when you're reading about people that you've heard of all your life, and they were just, she's not name dropping. This is who she grew up with. Aki is Oscar Hammerstein. Rogers is her father. If you want a copy of that, make a gift of $50 to BAI. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. I think our final song is Betty Davis from a movie. And she doesn't sing well in this either, but it's, I think it was Stage Door Canteen that she sang.
Thank you, Lucky Stars.
Thank you. Oh, that was the movie? Thank you, Lucky Stars. Oh, Sean, thank you.
I wrote it in the thing.
Did you? Well, what do I know? It was written by Arthur Schwartz and Frank Lesser, and it's not musical excellence, but it's a film curiosity. Betty Davis. Let's hear her.
You marched away and left this town as empty as can be, and I am like the driftwood in a deadly calm at sea. I can't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me, for there is no secret lover that the draft board didn't discover. They're either too young or too old. They're either too gray or too grassy green. The pickings are poor and the crop is lean. What's good is in the army. What's left will never harm me. They're either too old or too young. So, darling, you'll never get stung. Tomorrow I'll go hiking with that Eagle Scout, unless I get a call from Grandpa for a snappy game of chess. They're either too warm or too cold. They're either too fast or too fast asleep. So, darling, believe me, I'm yours to keep. There isn't any gravy. The gravy's in the Navy. They're either too fresh or too stale. There is no available mail. I will confess to one romance, I'm sure you will allow. He tries to serenade me, but his voice is changing now. They're easy. either too bald or too bold. I'm down to the wheelchair and bassinet. My heart just refuses to get upset. I simply can't compel it to, with no Marines to tell it to. I'm either their first breath of spring, or else I'm their last little fling. I either get a fossil or an adolescent pup. I either have to hold him off or have to hold him up. The battle is on, but the fortress will hold. They're either too young or too old. I'll never, never fail you when you are in Australia or out in the Aleutians or off among the Russians and flying over Egypt. Your heart will never be gypped. And when you get to India, I'll still be what I've been there. I've looked the field over, and lo and behold,
Betty Davis, I'll be with you on Monday at 10, next Saturday at 8. Have a good weekend. Thanks for joining us.
$0.33 a day, not much, is it? Boost change, a third of a cup of coffee, it's nothing. But did you know that $0.33 a day can help WBAI stay on the air? That's all it takes. As little as $0.33 a day, $10 a month, you can be a BAI buddy. A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a recurring monthly donation to WBAI using either a credit card, debit card, or by electronic fund transfer from your bank account. It's safe, secure, and easy, and it helps keep our unique, alternative, and diverse programming on the air. You'll get a WBAI membership card and other goodies. Sign up online. Go to WBAI.org and click on donate. All the details are right there. The WBAI buddy. Be one today.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Any Saturday with David Rothenberg came to you live over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Normally at 10 o'clock, you would hear On the Count. That is not on today. You'll be back next week. Instead, you'll hear a Gary Null special. So please, stay tuned.
Extinction Diaries. The Yangtze River in China is the longest river in Asia and home of some of the oldest living species dating back hundreds of millions of years. The river is also one of the most polluted on Earth. Sadly, the Yangtze is where two recent extinctions happened. The Baiji dolphin and the Chinese paddlefish. Another resident is on the extinction radar. 10 years ago, there were over 1,800 Yangtze River finless porpoise, and today there is less than 500. The incredible marine mammal is thought to have the intelligence of a gorilla and is known for playful antics like tail stands while wearing a mischievous smile. They lack a dorsal fin, hence the name, and the genetics show that the finless porpoise is the oldest living member of the porpoise species. The Yangtze finless porpoise generates both high and low frequencies, one for communication, one for echolocation. This ancient relative has all the high-tech evolution our planet can muster, and yet without a rapid evolution of human consciousness,